Let's give ourselves a hand.
Gary, I brought something. When we last time we were talking about Thelma and Elijah, I got way too intrigued for my own good about Thelma, and so I did a bunch of research, and I typed it up for you because it just seemed silly to keep it all to myself. But and I did find some things that I thought would be really interesting for all of you. The first page is the passage in the Bible that actually tells the story of Thelma. And then the second page is the lineage of the Herod, but I went ahead and copied it, but this website was... It's a convoluted history anyway, and I didn't think that the truth is done. So then the third page is what you really need to know to understand what... So there was a tetrarch of kings. It was Herod the Great, who had 10 wives and many, many children, and he was the one who was king when Jesus was born, and he was the one who ordered all babies under a year, male babies killed, including two of his own children, which is favorite wife, because they were of the family that he liked, and so he didn't even trust his most beloved. And then one of his sons is Herod Philip. So Herod is just like king. It's not really a name. And Philip was married to Herodias. Herodias was the daughter of Aristobulus, who was another son of Herod the Great. But Philip and Aristobulus were half-brothers. So she married him not for love, but out of pure ambition, because he was in line. But then Herod the Great divided his kingdom into four parts. And she wasn't too happy about that, because Philip was pretty retiring, and he was just kind of happy to get some land and some power, and she wanted much more than that. So when Herod Antipas came to get, and who was Philip's full brother, came to get his investiture of his part of the tetrarch, he stayed in Rome, which is where Philip and Herodias were, and he stayed with them, and she seduced him and talked him into divorcing his wife. Thelma was her daughter with Philip. When they divorced, she went with Antipas. And Antipas is the Herod that Pilate sent Jesus to. And he was, Jesus compared him to a fox, not only because of his cunning, but because of his cruelty. And because foxes at that time were considered ritually unclean. So he was saying that he's dirty in every way. And so it wasn't only John the Baptist that was speaking against him. It was also Jesus. And so Thelma is not named. She's only named as Herodias' daughter at any place in the Bible. Well, the way that we have her name is Josephus, who is the earliest church historian. He is thought to be very accurate, but there's nothing in the Bible that says what's her name. And she's often depicted as doing the dance of the seven veils. She was very lascivious in her dancing, and she was supposed to be very beautiful. And so there's this sense, even though they never say it, that it was really lust. That it wasn't, look, my daughter or my wife's daughter is doing this thing to me, but whoa, mama, kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And he offered her up to half his kingdom for the dance that she did. Now, he was very superstitious and didn't really like it. He was very much in awe of John the Baptist. And so he imprisoned him because he was frightened of him. But he was starting to kind of listen to him. And Herodias saw that as a huge problem. Because John the Baptist was saying our marriage isn't good, and if you decide it's not good, I don't have any power, and I am in this for the power. So her brother, Herodias' brother Agrippa, was then the last of the four tetrarchs. And he was a good friend of Caligula. And so Caligula named him king. Before, it had only been Herod, which was a Jewish title for to have this in him. So he named him king, and Herodias said, oh, no, Antipas, you've got to get in touch with Caligula and tell him that you're going to be king too. And Caligula said, no, you know what, if you're going to be like that, I'm just keeping the rest of your tetrarch, you're part of it, and I'm giving it to Agrippa. And you're in exile, and he was banished to Gaul, and he offered Herodias her freedom, but she went with Antipas. So then, the last page, and this is where I thought it got really interesting, is that there is a woman named Salome in the Bible. She is the mother of the disciples, James and John, and she's the wife of Zebedee. And she is, there are a lot of scholars think that she might have been Mary's sister, Mary, the mother of God, so Jesus' aunt. That's not proven, but I put in some verses here that support that. And she was at the crucifixion, she was at the resurrection. Her husband was a man of means, so she was a financial supporter, and she was a stereotypical Jewish mother in that, you know, I've got these sons, and they're your cousins, and she was hugely ambitious for them to be the greatest of the apostles. And so she was the one who said, please, Jesus, promise me that you'll let this be at one of my sons be at your right hand and one be at my left, and which was a really quite a bold move for a woman in that time to ask on behalf of her son. They should have asked for themselves. And so Jesus didn't get really angry with her, but he said, you know, that's not for me to decide. When he was taken then to Herod Antipas, the scholarly thought is that Herodias also had a lot to do, because he was no friend of hers either. So it's thought, although we don't have any text that proves it, that she said, this is a joke. We can do it with him too now. And so Antipas didn't take it seriously that he should even consider pardoning him, because Herodias said no. And he already got rid of John the Baptist. James and John appear to have been followers of John the Baptist first. Then Jesus called them as his disciples. So there's all of this intimate linkage, and I just found it really interesting that for young, Salome is all about lust and material desire, ambition, and the person that he says that he's talking to is never named, but the person who is named has the same characteristic, although working for good instead of evil. And so I thought, you know, how interesting this, that of all the people that name was pulled out of the collective. And I hope that's helpful, because it helps me a lot. So I just thought, well, if I've done all this for me, I might as well.
Thank you.
It's really, yeah.
It's a nexus. Well, welcome back. And you all got the dates for the fall. Karen, you'll tell them that we're stopping over the summer and give them the dates for the fall.
Okay.
And just, you know, a lot of people are pitching in to make this work. Thanks to Carol for all the work on the slides. And Karen and Tammy for negotiating for the church, and Kathy for bringing all that stuff with the projector, and you for just coming. So.
And
me.
And you.
You're welcome. I enjoy it. I think it's some of the best stuff we've ever done. It is certainly the densest stuff we've ever done. But it's really the foundation for everything we've ever done. So I think I'm supposed to say the date. Today is the 27th of May. And we'll start out with a review, and then we'll pick up. It gets heavy again, so put on your thinking cap. We're dealing with this dialogue between Jung, Elijah, and Salome. It's terribly important, I think, because to step back and simplify it a bit, you could say Elijah is going to be the forerunner of Philemon. We'll get to that guy down the road. And that's wisdom. Again, saying it maybe overly simply, but just to give us something to hold on to. Getting to Elijah, getting to Philemon, is getting to the ability to create Jungian psychology. I think they are the voice of represent the voice in Jung that developed Jungian psychology. But to get there, he's got to go through this wretched woman, Salome. And we'll see much more of it today. She is essentially an accessory to murder. He calls her full of vain greed and criminal lust. And it troubles him that he knows he too is a murderer because he killed Siegfried. So he's saying, is this my anima, my killer anima? And yeah, it is. What we're going to see eventually is Salome is redeemed. But he has to go through it to redeem it. And I think his relationship with Tony Wolf is based on the Salome anima figure. Sam, you asked some time ago, and I checked and I forgot to report back. He started his analytic work with Tony Wolf in 1910. Just about this time, they were beginning an intimate relationship, according to Deidre Baer, who may or may not be trustworthy. But it's probably about this time that he's wrestling with that fact. So I don't think it's unrealistic to link up what he's dealing with Salome, with what he has to deal with in himself as he connects up with Tony Wolf. Because without Tony Wolf, we wouldn't have Jungian psychology, that's for sure, at least in my opinion. She was able to be with him in a way Emma wasn't. I think Emma had a practical intelligence, but Tony Wolf an imaginative intelligence. So that's pretty much what we did last time. And I think that took us to 247. The other thing we just talked about briefly was the picture there of Salome, Jung, and Elijah struck me as being next to a mosque. We haven't really discussed that. He doesn't discuss it, but I don't think it's an accident. But that somehow this is tied in with our current political situation. So we start with 247. Some of this we can go more quickly over, but when we get to phase or part two of this dialogue with Salome and Philemon, we'll slow down again. So the top left of 247, he reports that this is like the crater of a volcano. Which would mean that's what he felt inside, full of hot, overpowering emotion, burning him. Second paragraph, second big paragraph, because I have fallen into the source of chaos. Into the primordial beginning, I myself become smelted anew. So he's given up his desire for order, and he's let all those emotions come up, which are tearing him apart. And he sees that as what is reshaping him, melting him. Then the last paragraph there, I'd like to go through slowly, because he interprets Salome and Elijah. And I get confused here too, so maybe we can work together. The powers of my depth are predetermination and pleasure.
Where are you, Gary?
The last paragraph on the left column on 247. The powers of my depths are predetermination and pleasure. And as the footnote says, this is a subjective interpretation of the figures of Elijah and Salome. So Salome is pleasure. Elijah is predetermination or forethinking. I think forethinking is an easier word to work with. Now, what's forethinking? And how does it differ from thinking? Some of you heard the story, but let me tell it again. I think it puts some clarity on this for me. My teacher in Switzerland, who was the district commissioner in Basutoland, have you all heard that story? Some of you have it, some of you haven't probably. One of my teachers, he's now deceased, was a young Oxford graduate, was a linguist, and went to a little protectorate within South Africa, then a protectorate of the Commonwealth, British Commonwealth. I think now it's its own country. And he was the district commissioner there, in this little aboriginal, really Neolithic state, and learned the language, as he was a linguist. And he said he was sitting around, he said when he moved in, he looked in the back, and he saw like 250 gin bottles, empty gin bottles piled up in the trash, and he said, I've got to do something so that that's not my fate. So he learned Basuto, and really he got to know the folks, and said he was speaking to the chief one day, and he said to the chief, what's the difference, can you tell me the difference between your people and my people? They call themselves the brown people, and they call whites the white people. What's the difference between white people and brown people? And the chief said, oh, that's easy. You think in thoughts, and we think in pictures. So I think, I say it because I believe that's what forethinking is. It's thinking in pictures, imagistic thinking.
So basically, the action, how would you relate it to how we've talked about the action of the Spirit as the generator?
It's the language of the action of the Spirit.
Forethinking is that image. The image is a language.
Yeah, but the Spirit speaks in images,
mm-hmm.
And forethinking is the mental process that thinks that way. That's really important.
Forethinking is a mental. So it's the conscious process you're saying?
Well, it's semi-conscious. See, thinking thinks. But with picture thinking, thoughts occur. That's the critical distinction. Thinking is focused for thinking or imaginative thinking or picture thinking is diffuse. You have a thought. You don't think a thought.
Okay, so say it again then. Spirit is the factor that generates the images.
Yeah, and
forethinking is, could you contrast them for me?
Well, forethinking would be the mode of thinking that apprehends that spirit.
That apprehends the images of the Spirit.
So, you know, the Spirit produces a certain image, but that's got to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
And then that thought process that works by way of images and understands by way of images is image thinking. It's the artistic process.
So that's
all forethinking. See, you paint a picture, and then you ask yourself, what's it mean? Then you think about it.
And that's the forethinking.
The forethinking is the painting of the picture.
So which was unconscious.
Which is it's sort of a conscious, unconscious thought process.
Could you say, Gary, that it's the breaking in of the unconscious?
Yeah, right.
I would say, maybe for me it's the dream image, and I think about the dream image later. So having the dream image would be important.
To work with dreams, you have to be able to think in pictures.
See, he's equating Elijah with forethinking.
Right.
So we're saying that Elijah is not
something in the unconscious totally. Is that what we're saying?
That's another whole kettle of fish.
You had to mention
that. Well, I'm just saying that when I created this, I didn't put any thought into it. I didn't say, oh, it'd be nice to add that. It'd be nice to add this.
You just followed a feeling.
I just, I had spontaneous visualization.
There you go. Spontaneous visualization.
They came from the unconscious.
That's forethinking. Spontaneous visualization.
Well, for me, there was really no consciousness. Well,
you had to be conscious to do it.
Yeah, it comes up to, into your...
Well, consciousness has to see it coming,
right.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't govern the process.
Exactly, so that's the whole point. This is an ungoverned process.
It's a, would it be fair to say that it's, that that's a more primitive way
yeah.
of apprehending?
Absolutely. I'm not crazy about the word primitive, but it's more primal, more elemental. It is a presentation of what is real. Where thinking can think anything. But this process simply shows you in image form what is. Now you said, is it only inside? I think basically it shows you what's inside yourself, but we also know this process shows you what's going on outside. So it gets into the psychoid dimension, blah, blah, blah.
Mm-hmm.
But another way to put this is Elijah represents Jung's imagination. But understand how we're using the word imagination as this spontaneous visualizing capacity, which presents, see, it really presents facts, but inner facts in the form of an image. But Jung, we will be seeing, says those inner images is as much a fact as the fact that that projector is over there.
Well, I think they are facts because, you know, for here he talks about, he equates forethinking with Prometheus and fire.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how the painting portrayed it.
Yeah.
The thing that comes down from the element that seems equivalent to
right.
forethinking are the fire
right.
fish.
And it's often linked to the future. The images that come up, sometimes you can trace back as having a cause, but more often than not, you can't. Because they don't have a cause, they have a purpose.
They're trying to lead us.
They're trying to lead us and in the deepest sense, our civilization forward. And it is creative. And it is resting, you might say, from... primal unconsciousness, the ability to change. That's the Promethean aspect of it.
You know, it seems that we're getting, we are being exposed to two ways that the unconscious shapes us. The Elijah aspect and the Salome aspect.
Wrong.
Is it? It's wrong.
They're the same.
But their actions
two
he's describing
aspects.
as acting on us in different ways.
Well, let me try to put it differently. See, what I think is that forethinking at its most creative level does not operate separate from sexuality.
Right. It looks like he's saying that there are two factors working together.
Working together.
And one factor is this Elijah factor, and the yeah. other is the Salome factor. And it seems similar to what he later describes as the action of Sophia and the action of Spirit.
Yep. Yep, exactly right.
Okay.
But see, what's so difficult here is he's realizing... He doesn't, his wife, the sexuality with his wife doesn't do anything for his imagination. His sexuality with Tony Wolf does do something for his imagination. And he realizes the only way to get to his imagination is in a sexual relationship. Those two are working together.
Is that just for him, or is he saying that's for everyone?
Well... That's a good question. I don't know. I'm tempted to say, first of all, be glad none of us are creative. By that I mean, we're not Picassos, you know, we're not Van Goghs, but with a creativity that is that world-shaping as Jung's was, and as, say, Picasso's was, and Rilke's. I mean, all these guys had terribly screwed up sex lives. And they were constantly falling into something, in love with somebody, having an affair, and then moving into a new phase of their creativity. And, you know, you can say that's bad. It doesn't matter whether it's bad or good. That's what creativity is at its deepest level. And that's what Jung was coming to terms with, because, you know, I feel he was essentially a very moral human being, knowing that he had to break his morality to develop his psychology.
You know, it feels like, or something I've been thinking about lately, it feels as though what he was able to do with both of those relationships that so few can do is he didn't negate one
right
in favor of the other. He didn't hold one up and say this, you know, that practicality
yeah
just bores me to pieces.
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
He saw the value in
yeah
that. But he also saw
absolutely
the value in
yeah
the other.
And that's the suffering that he's beginning to explore here. See, I think he's just beginning his sexual relationship with Toshimo. And he's realizing he can't get to Elijah without Salome. And he's living out Salome with Tony Wolf. And he also realizes Salome is a killer. So in order to create, he has to wrestle with all this horrible stuff that he knows is wrong, but which is essential for the completion of his larger task. And I think you're absolutely right, Patty. Just in answering Sandy's question, I went back and, you know, read through this, as you've heard me say, what I think is a horrible book by Deidre Baer about Jung. And, you know, she says, oh, you know, Tony Wolf and Emma Jung hated each other. That is an absolute lie. I know they both went to C.A. Meyer, my supervisor, to work on their friendship. But the popular mind has to always put it as either or, and not realizing that all three people really went through hell. And I think they did it because they knew this wasn't done for Jung. They knew a worldview was being generated and that they were all caught in the nexus and they had to face it or pass it on, pass the problem on to their children. And all of those kids married happily. I think that's the bottom line. And, you know, you get all this stuff about Jung and, you know, what a jerk he was. The friends that I visit in France, she is friends with Jung's last surviving daughter, Lil. And Lil said to her, you know, the thing that bothers me most about getting old is, if you'll pardon, this is what her, a direct quote, I'm too tired of arguing with all those son of a bitches who want to put down my dad. He was a fantastic father. Now, that's from the daughter. So in the midst of all of this, he was still being a father.
Yeah.
And carrying the knowledge of adultery, the pleasure of adultery, the guilt of hurting his wife, the guilt of knowing probably Tony Wolf would never marry, but doing it anyway because he felt he had to do this and create this psychology. And I think that's what we're dealing with in this Salome and Elijah bit. And Carol, you're absolutely right. They go together. That the erotic and the imaginative cannot be separated. That's what he is coming to grips with. That sounds great until you realize that following that breaks your moral code.
And I suppose, you know, eroticism can extend beyond a feeling for another human being.
Yes, right.
There can be in my experience, an eroticism towards matter itself.
I think the reason this stuff is so interesting after all these years is because Jung's eros is in that writing. It's never abstract. it's always dealing with the life pulse.
Gary, I mean, at this point, he's not thinking, I have to pursue this in order to create any psychology. He would be torn, I have to pursue this, something that's driving me. I have this image, right? Because he's not sure what the outcome, because the point...
Yeah.
What he would be at is you wouldn't even know the outcome.
Right.
So you're having to pursue this not knowing if it's only going to
happen. I don't know for sure, but my guess is, you know, when he split from Freud, he just went to pieces. And he said, in my mind, he was saying to himself, I've got to do something to pull myself together here. And so this is what he turned to. And so it becomes kind of a chicken and egg. I've got this woman. I have this frustration with Freud. I have my own ideas. I've got this wife. I've got these five kids. This then slowly starts to guide him half, I think, maybe anticipating where it was going, half having no clue where it was going. And really letting this fantasy create him as he dialogues with it.
He did have the experience, though, of working with a lot of patients and seeing that in working with those images, there was some transcendent function that got activated.
But at this point, he didn't know there was such a thing as a transcendent function.
Okay.
Well, he had hints there was such a thing as a transcendent function, but that didn't get clear to him until 15 years later. So this is really just in the beginning of forming his own standpoint. And I think he had intimations of all of it, but probably more doubts than certainties about the validity of it. Hi, Karen.
Hi, have a good summer in the fall.
Okay.
You mentioned the word form, and that is in this paragraph, and I'm totally confused. It's starting with four.
Yeah, let's go through it now. I just kind of want to set the context.
Yeah.
Predetermination of forethinking is Prometheus. Hopefully that makes sense. That's the creative imagination, which is developing a step in cultural evolution. Who without determined thoughts brings the chaotic to form and definition? Who digs the channels and holds the object before pleasure? I think the form is the Jungian psychology that's being created out of the imagination.
Keep going.
But pleasure is the force. Is that right?
Thinking also comes
before thought.
Right.
So that's the imaginative prior.
Well, that makes forethinking sound like an unconscious process.
I think it is.
Okay, I thought you were saying just the opposite.
Well, I think part of the problem is the use of the word unconscious. I distinguish between consciousness and awareness. A process can be unconscious, and we can still be aware of it. So that the imaginative thinking is unconscious, meaning consciousness doesn't direct it. It happens. And we can be aware of it, meaning we can perceive it even though we're not creating it.
It's available to consciousness.
It's available to consciousness.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yes, thank you.
I'm just distinguishing between consciousness and awareness. Because generally when we say unconscious, we are often meaning unaware, and they're not the same. Unconscious is the opposite of conscious, meaning consciousness meaning directed. So unconscious is undirected. My willpower isn't making it happen. So fantasy thinking is unconscious, though I might be aware of it, I might be perceiving it, but I am not shaping it. So you have a daydream. You snap out of it, and all of a sudden you realize a story has been constructed in you. You didn't plan it out. You just fell into a reverie. Now, you may be unaware of it, or you may be aware of it. And to be aware of it means that you snap out of it and realize what's just trans, almost like what film has just played across your eyeballs. Or you, let's suppose it's a sexual fantasy. You could say, well, I have no sexual feelings for that person. You could also be utterly unaware of it. So that's why I think it's helpful to distinguish between consciousness and awareness. Consciousness doesn't mean not unconscious, doesn't mean not perceived. It means happening without conscious control.
Because there are certain things in the unconscious that are not available.
And there are unconscious processes which are unaware as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And here, you see, Jung is, when we say the word unconscious, we are generally using it in the Freudian sense. Jung, when he says unconscious, he means autonomous, separate from the will.
So it's like an entity in itself.
It's like, not like, it is an entity in itself, right. That help?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
He's giving fantasy primacy. That's what he's trying to do. Because we say, oh, it's just a fantasy. He said, well, fantasy is as much a fact as anything else. Because it's a picture of the inner world showing itself.
And Elijah, you told him that later on.
Yeah, and so see, we're just now getting into the stuff. Part of the problem of reading this is we've all read the later Jung, where all these conclusions have been made. He hasn't made these conclusions yet.
That's why his words are confusing to me.
Yeah, and I don't think he always knows what he's talking about either. Yeah, it's confusing. And we'll see things that later he says just the opposite.
So at this point, it's like when you're writing, you try and understand something.
Mm-hmm.
Writing to try and teach somebody about
right.
the audience.
Yeah.
Can I read just this one sentence?
Yes.
It's right after the forethinking. But pleasure is the force that desires and destroys forms without form and definition.
Right. Well, pleasure, I'm understanding, is the pull he has towards Tony Wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And again, we think of the imaginal and the sexual as separate. But what he's realizing is they are the same thing. So that because his imagination is about creating a new world, his sexuality is operating in the exact same way.
What is this? Destroys forms without form.
Well, destroys the old forms.
Oh, thank you. That helps me.
Yeah.
Forms that don't have form and definition is what he's...
No longer have a useful form and definition. I think, you know, remember we've got Salome and Elijah as two things, but really they're two sides of the same coin, the snake, we'll see in a minute. So, what he's said to himself is, oh my God, my sexuality has led me into a relationship with this woman, and the nature of this relationship is to discuss things and throw out old understandings and to create new understandings. And that sexual attraction to her is as much the creation, as much the destruction and the creation as the cognitive process of creating and destroying. And I can't separate. I can't say, oh, well, you know, I'm going to have a sexual feeling for so-and-so, and then I'm going to create over here, because they're working together. She is the one who is helping him destroy, and she is the one that's helping him create. And he realizes he can't think and feel separately. And it's bugging him.
He tries to compartmentalize.
He is forced to stop compartmentalizing. And we would love to live in a sanitary world. But I think when creativity is at the level of generating a future point of view for the society, this is the way it works. And it's dangerous because there'll be plenty of petty creators who will use this as an excuse for having affairs. But you can see the difference is he's tormented.
So in the living symbol, when Adler started having feelings for his patient, it was like this big taboo. I could ruin her. She's never individuate. So how? But isn't that what happened to you?
Well, they stopped working together. He and Tony Wolf. I don't know how long. A year maybe. Didn't see each other.
At all, or as patients?
At all.
And then it started again?
And then they began a personal relationship. It was no longer a professional relationship.
I'm trying to articulate, so I'm trying to get a hold of it.
Yeah.
It's like all the cultural moorings and craft that society's moving. Press down, I can't think of the right word. They stop the creativity. I mean, they hold it down and control it. And so the only way you can become creative is you've got to have the force that comes through sexuality or libido to break through this.
Right. Right. That's yeah. The only thing I think I'd add is, and here's where it gets dangerous, so I want to clarify it. I think there are levels of creativity. Those people who are creating forms which will shape the entire society, this is what they have to go through.
They have to be willing to turn aside from the rules and let that come on.
Knowing there are other rules which are even more exacting that they have to follow.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Yeah. So that passion and imagination, Jung is realizing, go hand in hand. I think sooner or later, I have enough faith in humanity that sooner or later it is. It may not be in your lifetime. Like Van Gogh, for example. Yeah. Yeah, look at him. I mean, he was promiscuous as hell. And, you know, I don't fault him a bit. I don't think his wife did either. Because if you're carrying that big a load, where do you get your energy to do it?
Well, that's how polygamy developed in Mormonism, because Joseph Smith was the only thing that he had against him was that he was incredibly promiscuous. And some of the people started questioning him. So then he had a revelation that actually he can have multiple wives. And
that's awfully convenient.
Well, because his wife said, "I won't support this ministry anymore if you're not going to stay faithful." But then when he had the revelation, there wasn't much she could do.
It's not quite the same, I hope you realize.
Yeah.
Well, but he said that it was a need that it fueled the creative, that when he was with all these other women, he was more open to what the angels were saying to him. So it seems very similar.
Well, I make a value judgment. I think Mormonism is a horrible thing.
Well, I do too, but I'm just looking,
but if his wife didn't go along with it, and then all of a sudden he had this revelation,
what makes
it
Like Henry VIII, please change the meaning.
Exactly.
Right, so are all of these changes in society that come about through a process of creativity, are they all positive? A lot of Mormon people would say that that was a fine thing. If their life is better for their faith.
Well, I see a major difference. I don't see young as promiscuous.
Yeah, I don't either.
He had a lifelong relationship with this woman.
With these two women.
Not a promiscuous thing.
Yeah.
It did. It's like, well, I mean, it's just so different than going from branch to branch.
I mean,
you know, it's just entirely a different thing. It's a lifelong.
And that's what he's coming to grips with here. You see that if he wants to create, he can't parcel off his eroticism. He can't parcel off his eroticism if he wants to create. That's what he's coming to grips with. How nice just to sit down and write a lovely book. But no, it's got to be wet and loving. Otherwise, he doesn't write.
Would Emma be represented by Elijah then? Elijah being the...
No, I think Elijah... I see what you're saying. No, I think Elijah would be Jung's own imagination.
You know, I'm just trying to make a connection here. When Von Franz said that she really couldn't write and she was depressed, I'm trying to connect that to the passion and eroticism and creativity.
I think she'd be the first to say my creativity and Jung's creativity are worlds apart. I'm really just putting footnotes in Jung's work. It's when we bring up a totally new worldview that I think this is likely to come up.
And her suffering, he had suffering in his creativity. He was suffering with the guilt of changing and of being torn between the pleasure of being known as a good person and the pleasure of
some
wolf. And her suffering for her creativity was different. It had to do with going into her depths of depression.
Von Franz, you mean?
Von Franz.
Yeah.
And so... each of them chose to suffer in a way to deal with it.
But I think Jane's point is too, Jung had an erotic fire behind him in his creativity. I don't know whether Von Franz did or not. I just don't know. I sort of doubt it. Because it was what that stuff was already brought up, and so it needed to be expounded, not discovered. It's when it's in the process of discovery that these two, Elijah and Salome, are likely to be at issue.
There's something erotic about any strong emotion. You know, the pain that comes with the deep depression is the emotion is so heavy that it can, at a certain level, become transcendent, which is also what happens with an intimate physical relationship is good. And the same thing that happens with, getting caught up in a pep rally or a bull fight that, you stand back and I'm really part of this, but there's this pull because the emotion gets so strong. And there is a sort of physical change that happens in the body that's erotic, even, if you don't. I think that's why there's so much domestic violence during football games. Because
is there really?
Yeah, the Super Bowl emergency room is hugely one of the busiest nights of the year for domestic violence.
Wow.
Because teams lose or teams win, and the emotion is so high from this activity that it becomes a physical expression. So I think of eroticism as a physical manifestation of strong emotion. So maybe if we look at it that way, it's...
Mm-hmm. Ready for more?
I guess she tried to with Polly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean,
that's probably the closest.
I tried to be creative with Polly.
Right. And she definitely, I think, was on fire for him. And vice versa. It doesn't get any better. You see where we stop with Sandy's question.
We've done like two paragraphs.
We've really done about three sentences.
But this whole thing of forethinking and pleasure is
it's crucial.
So basic
it
is so basic. His psychology, and to see it forming here is very interesting.
Yes, I feel exactly the same way. And it's not pleasant. You know, I'm going off to this conference Saturday, and they're having one of my least favorite people piped in to talk about the Red Book, Murray Stein. And I looked at some of the workshops that are going to be given, and one is finding your own filling role. Your own filling role. No mention of all this hell. Yeah. That has to go through before you even get to Philemon. See how we want to sanitize it.
Now, Stein has become the representative of the Red Book and all these things.
Really?
What do you think, what is his take that really irritates you? He's a power monger, and what, he subverts the text to his own...
I don't know how he's going to deal with this, but in the workshops I've done with him and in the books I've read, it's just fascinating.
Just glosses over.
I think it's a gloss.
All the difficulty and the complications.
And the complications and the lack of ego gratification that comes.
Mm-hmm. So he's a sort of finding your bliss kind of guy?
I don't know if it's that bad, but... the people that really should be talking about it are the people who worked on the book. And he sort of put himself in the media's eye where he's the authority, and who are they?
You mean like Sam Dasani?
Sam Dasani, John Peck, and I forget who the other guy is. And John Peck is actually a friend of mine. He was so turned off by all this, he refuses to talk on it.
Really?
Yeah.
I think he is doing something though this summer.
The only one he agreed to do, and he regretted it.
Or something like that.
It might be worth hearing.
Yeah.
I mean, I would listen to him.
He's that Young and the Hudson series.
Oh,
I think he's doing something related to the Red Book, but I'm not sure exactly. Do you know what the title is?
No, but it is on the Red Book. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
The whole thing is the whole week.
Yeah.
And they're going to be several people who work.
Mm-hmm. The word pleasure, do you think that he would have changed that later?
Nope.
Okay. And maybe it's just because of the connotation our culture gives it. It just seems superficial. I don't think it's superficial as...
I don't see pleasure as superficial.
Well, I mean, the whole relationship with Tony and it's not just... I mean, it seems like it's richer than just... You know what I mean?
Yes.
I think it is. I mean, than just...
this pleasure and desire, I don't think we can't just narrow it down to sexuality. I mean, there's so much bigger.
But still, I think he's saying, I'm having fun here.
At his age, it's all about that. It's all about sex, I'm sure.
I don't know if it's all about sex, but...
He's a guy.
Okay. Some things we won't touch.
Hey, this is what they tell me.
Oh, well. And who's they?
The guys.
Oh.
I kind of notice it, too, right?
You told
me. I didn't mean to open Pandora's box. I just wondered if he would have later.
I think that's part of it, that it is also a superficial pleasure. And he wants his superficial pleasures.
But it's also richer than that.
But and that's the taboo, his pleasure. See what I mean?
You can
have a meaningful sexual relationship, but just to have sex for fun.
You're coming at the Victorianism here.
Yeah.
When pleasure was like a no-no.
Right. And still, I think he's saying that just the fun of two people being together is part of it too. It's not all, but it's part of it too. And the lower man, that's where he starts. The Germans have this wonderful word, Schweinhund. You ever hear that in the German movies, Die Schweinhund? It means pig dog. And it's a wonderful word for the lowest level of desire, pig dog. When I see my Euro friends, they always say, how's your pig dog? You know, is he happy or not happy? And maybe he's happy, maybe he's not. But the pig dog has to be happy too. And Jung, I think, is acknowledging his pig dog is happy in this relationship. And no, it's not grand and cultural, but it is an ingredient of the whole experience. And not to denigrate the importance of just physical fun.
I wonder, too, about the intensity of emotion actually producing the image of Elijah and Salome. You know, that you have the emotion and out of that comes the image. Or did that image come first? I'm just trying to think about the role of Eros in the process of getting these images that transcend, and
I'm not sure
he could grow his psychology from, and the need to have that intense emotional experience in order for that to open you up.
I think it's, if we can, the best we can visualize it, it's simultaneous.
Okay. And
the reason we're having difficulty here is that most of us realize there's a distinction between our sexuality and our imagination. But Jung is staring in the face the fact that in him at this moment there is no difference. That's how I've never read that he says that, but that's my sense of what's going on. And working with people who themselves are caught in, you know, in erotic messes. It's not like you have an erotic mess and then you get out of it. It's that the erotic mess is the first step in the new generation, the new genesis. But we separate our minds and our bodies. And Jung is going back to the fact his body and his mind are working together.
But he's also got the Elijah figure there as the seer and wisdom to also lead him through that process. Most people, when they fall into that, don't
have
that.
Right, because, can we get four sentences done? The fourth thinker is a seer, but pleasure is blind.
Right. And that's why she's blind.
That's why she's mm-hmm. blind. Mm-hmm. That's why Jung, I think, at this point, was getting in all these messes. His eros was blind. Which I understand to mean he just finds himself in these situations of attraction. He doesn't choose them. He doesn't wish them to be. But that's what keeps hitting him in the face. Now, he could say, I will control that. But he's had enough of Freudian analysis to realize that's libido. Unfortunately, it puts him into situations he wishes he weren't in. And that's the price he's paying. So you could say the blindness of Salome is the fact he gets drawn into these situations. And then Elijah will be the insight that with which he creates and then gets himself out of the situation. Eventually, Salome will get her sight back. And then I think at that point he wasn't as pulled as he was. I think he was simply tormented with a sexual attraction at this point.
Just
every sentence.
I know, because then it says, but pleasure is power.
Yeah, yeah. Well, he says, forethinking is not powerful in itself, and therefore does
right.
not move.
Right.
But pleasure is power,
right.
and therefore it moves.
Yes.
That's because it's libido and it has energy behind
right.
it. That's the kind of power I think he's talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah, that's the kind of power he's talking about.
Okay.
So that... if he just sat, he couldn't just sit down and say, I think I'm going to create Jungian psychology. No, he was pulled into the need to think through the complexity of his emotions with Tony. And without that, nothing would have been creative. And of all the women around, she was the one who was capable of helping him do this. So there's a bit of a sync. He's not saying that at this point, but I think there's a bit of a synchronistic element here. That again, it's not just that he can't think if he's not having sex. It's he's in this relationship which is both erotic and intellectual, and they belong together. And without the erotic, the suffering wouldn't generate the thought, and without that. Erotic, meaning the thought anyway. And the erotic has pulled him just to the one person who can help him do the thinking. It's time for a piece of cake.